Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jimmy Floyd in for Brian Lehrer, and next we take a deep dive into the topic of male guards, female inmates, and sexual abuse in New York State prisons. In January, the Federal Bureau of Prisons released a national survey of inmates. They ranked 11 participating correctional facilities. The four that posted the highest rate of inmate-alleged sexual abuse in the country were here in New York State. The top-ranked facility was Bayview Correctional for women. That's right here in Manhattan. But now a city limits investigation finds that the federal report was not the end of the story. It was just the beginning. The city limits investigation, which is now online, finds that sexual misconduct in New York's prisons eludes stereotypes and sometimes even detection. Joining me now to talk about why and how is Kelly Varia. She is the deputy editor of City Limits, and she spearheaded this investigation. Kelly, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Jamie.
And I should mention that Kelly is right here in the studio with me, so we can put the law right here on the table here in our studio, because the law is very clear and it becomes very important when looking at prisons, women's prisons especially, and we're going to see why in just a moment. The law is that any person in custody cannot legally consent to any sex act with an employee of the Department of Corrections, right, Kelly? And
that's
employee
right.
Is very broadly defined, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it means anyone who has any kind of contact with the prisoner. So that would include corrections officers, definitely teachers, healthcare providers, psychologists, doctors, et cetera.
And that means all sexual contact, even where the inmate is willing to participate. Why is that? Is that because the law assumes that there is a certain power dynamic in the prison setting?
That's right. I mean, it was explained to me best, I think, by a scholar who researches this area. She works at George Washington University. And she said that, you know, if you think about it, like the dynamics that existed during slavery times between slaves and their, you know, masters, and how a lot of slave women were forced into sexual relations with their masters, it's a similar dynamic in a prison setting. Well, albeit, you know, prison is far less, is not nearly as bad as slavery, but you can understand sort of the dynamics of force and coercion and pressure that would have to be involved in that situation, even if the person was a willing participant.
Now, despite the federal findings that we just mentioned, the Department of Corrections says that sexual abuse is actually rare in New York prisons and jails, correctional facilities, and that force is rarer still. They say there are only 79 substantiated cases from 2005 to 2009. But your investigation, which is available to our listeners online right now, suggests that the numbers just don't tell the whole story on the issue, right?
Right.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, there are a number of things that when we started digging deeper into it concerned us. And one of those was that when we looked at the documents where the prisons actually record the number of grievances that they received, for some prisons, they didn't match up with the number of, it was clear that some of the grievances were not actually reported to the Inspector General's office where they're supposed to be investigated. At least that's what the reports indicated. There were four different codes that people could mark off, and one of those codes was referred to the Inspector General's office. And so there was we looked at the seven facilities that house women, and I think it was about 15% of those incidents were never reported to the Inspector General's office. And it really varied per prison. So I would imagine that if we looked at the entire group of prisons, which I think the Department of Corrections has 67 facilities, if we looked at all of those, it's pretty clear that we would see a broad range of reporting. For instance, there was one facility, Bayview, which we talked about a lot in the story, that had reported virtually all to the Inspector General's office. And then there was another facility that had reported, not reported 70-something percent. So there was a very wide range.
And therefore, you launched your investigation. We do want to invite our listeners to call in, especially any who have experience with this issue as a former inmate, correctional officer, or certainly as an advocate in the courts. You can call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Kelly Faria. She's the deputy editor of City Limits, which has just published at citylimits.org, and it's extensive investigation into allegations of sexual abuse at New York State prisons. And if you're a listener who multitasks, you'll want to go to WNYC.org because we have a link to the report. And there are lots of graphs and statistics attached to the report that make it very visual and very easy to understand. And I want to get one thing out of the way, Kelly, because you mentioned that women inmates can become involved with women guards. And you also write that male prisons are not immune. But mostly you focus on the power dynamic between male correctional workers and female inmates. That's the primary focus of the report. Why so?
Well, that was because it was pretty clear by looking at the data that women, female inmates, were disproportionately involved in sexual abuse incidents. Female inmates make up only 4% of the state's prison population, but they were 25% of the substantiated incidents. So that's why we decided to focus on them.
And roughly how many women inmates are there behind bars in New York State at any given time?
As of January 1st, 2010, there were 58,000 inmates, and there were 2,500 female inmates.
And you spent a little bit of time at the beginning of the piece talking about lawsuits as a remedy. Some women do sue when they claim sexual abuse. Very often they lose. Sometime they win. But the bigger problem your investigation finds is silence. Why is that?
Why is that a problem, do you mean?
Why don't women come forward when they are abused in the prisons? That is the primary problem the investigation finds.
Yeah, there are a variety of reasons. I mean, sometimes it's because they perceive themselves as benefiting from it. Frankly, I mean, there are a lot of cases in which, you know, women are willing participants, as you talked about before, and some of the benefits that they receive are contraband. Sometimes the contraband involves cash payments. Sometimes the officers will put, when I say cash payments, I mean putting money into their commissary account so they can make purchases at the facility, may buy them shoes, various other food from the outside, that kind of thing. At other times, it's because they don't want to, they fear retaliation, and they don't want to become embroiled in an investigation. You know, they're afraid that if they expose themselves and they say that they've been assaulted or that they've been participating in some sort of sexual affair that they now want to end, that the officer or his friends or someone in management will punish them by putting them into segregation or something like that.
And chapter two of the investigation is called Repeat Offenders. You found that it seems to be the same officers involved over and over again. Why is that, if you were even able to ascertain that?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that I believe that they're the same officers involved over and over again. But I will say that that's certainly what some of the you know, attorneys who there was a legal aid attorneys who had done some research into this in preparation for filing a lawsuit. They talked to 300 different women, and what they found was that there were, you know, several there were a handful, just a couple officers who were major offenders,
and a lack of I don't want to use the word punishment, but a lack of investigation into the claims made by women.
Right, exactly. Because the burden of proof is really high for the woman, which to a certain extent you could understand, because there are people's jobs and livelihoods that are involved. But, you know, the women have to, if they report this, at least this is what the advocates have said, is that women have to be able to provide some sort of physical evidence that they have been sexually assaulted or that, you know, they had some sort of sexual contact with the officer. Doc says that that's not the case, but you know, there's a lot of conflict about that.
DOC being the Department of Corrections.
Right, the Department of Correctional Services.
Let's take a call from Deborah. She is in Newark, New Jersey. Deborah, please go ahead. You're on with Kelly Varilla. She is with City Limits. They've just published an extensive investigation into allegations of sexual abuse in New York State prisons. I understand you have some experience working in corrections yourself.
Yes, I did a very long time ago, 35 years ago. In 1976-77, I worked as a volunteer 9 hours a week, 3 days a week, 3 hours a day, in the women's camp of the Mississippi State Penitentiary at Parchment, infamous Parchment, when very, very few people could get in. I was living in a convent at the time, and that's how I gained access. And the level of reporting that Kelly's making reference to is just the tip of the iceberg, because penitentiaries, even though Parchment was the only state and federal penitentiary, was a consolidated thing. Now there are three in Mississippi. It was a kinder, gentler world for prisons than we have today. And yet even then, these women would not report what happened to them. They didn't dare, because the level of coercion, the level of threat, the level of menace, of malice, you don't dare report. And so you're just getting whatever is surfacing as a report. And if only 70% is being handed off to the state attorney general's office, or 70% isn't being handed off, is just the tip of the iceberg today.
Thank you, Deborah, very much for your call. And it sounds, Kelly, as if what Deborah experienced back in her day is very comparable to what you found in your investigation in terms of the reporting mechanism.
Right, which is, I think, one of the reasons that it makes it really difficult to say exactly, you know, how many officers are involved. I just feel like it's we don't actually know how prevalent this is. And that's one of the reasons why the Bureau of Justice Statistics does the research that they do, because they're trying to get a feel for what is actually going on in the state. And that's why they conduct those surveys.
I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Kelly Varilla.
Varilla.
A deputy editor, City Limits, which has just published at citylimits.com an investigation into allegations of sexual abuse in New York State prisons. And we are asking any listeners who have experience with the issue to call in 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Former inmates, correctional officers, or advocates in the courts, please call. You take a special lens to Bayview, and you devote a whole chapter to that facility. And I want to say that throughout your piece, you have the very human stories of these women and the men, the inmates, the guards. You tell their very real stories. So anyone who reads the piece will be very moved by all of this. It's not just graphs and numbers and statistics. And in the Bayview piece, you start with the story of Peter Z and Jeanette P. And this goes to this issue, and it's also intimated by Deborah's call, of consent and coercion. Can you speak a little bit to all of that and how it plays out, especially in light of the law that we put on the table at the beginning of our conversation? Because a woman may think she's consenting in one of these situations, but in the eyes of the law, it's not consent the way it would be in a relationship outside of prison.
Right.
Yet some of these relationships are relationships, at least in a way, right? So explain a little bit about, we've talked about the forcible. We've talked about cash that goes into commissary, or sneakers the women get, food, et cetera. But sometimes these are relationships, as
right.
in the Bayview case.
Sometimes these are actual romances, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we started off the story with talking about the incident in which the officer proposed to an inmate. But in the case of Jeanette and Peter, you know, they fell in love after, you know, seeing each other and having conversation with each other. And they had a 2-year relationship that resulted in a child. So, you know, I think it gets really complicated when you start to try to figure out, you know, whether a person is a willing participant and or not. And, you know, I think that their case is a really good example, because, I mean, she came into the relationship ostensibly willingly, but then, and you know, she said that one of the reasons why she was so excited about his interest in her was because she had been incarcerated for so many years and hadn't had any male attention, and it just made her feel good. But, you know, after a few months in the relationship, she testified that, you know, he became violent towards her. Uh-huh. And he began hitting her, and, you know, abusing her in various other ways. So, you know, and basically it was difficult for her to get out of the situation.
Yes, yes. And of course, again, in the eyes of the law, this is not a legal relationship, and it is a coercive relationship from the beginning.
Right.
Because he is a prison guard.
Right. And I think the Department of Correctional Services doesn't want the inmates, I mean, the employees having sex on the job.
That's right.
I mean, that should be said.
From jump, as the kids say. Now, let's talk a little more about Bayview, because it tops the national list, not just the list here in the state of New York for the most sexual assaults reported by inmates, but the national list in the federal survey. What is it, Kelly, that sets Bayview apart? Is there any way to ascertain what happens to make Bayview so dysfunctional?
Well, I'm not necessarily convinced that Bayview is the most dysfunctional, at least of those 160 facilities that were on the list. Because, you know, one thing to look at is that prisons that are involved in litigation were not actually supposed to receive the survey. Bayview is actually involved in litigation and should not have received the survey, should not have participated in the survey. So it was just a fluke that they actually participated in the survey. So it's entirely possible that other facilities in New York State or elsewhere in the country have far higher rates of inmate-reported sexual abuse and that they just didn't appear in those numbers. But, I mean, I felt like, you know, Bayview was just sort of a touchstone for us to talk about those issues. And in all honesty, I think Bayview also has a really small population as well. So it's possible that, you know, we could see some distortion in the numbers because it has a small population.
Well, talking about the issues is where the conversation begins, and hopefully we begin to consider corrective measures. And Kelly, we only have about 30 seconds left. What are some of the corrective measures that are in place? I know Department of Justice under Eric Holder is hoping to put some regulatory measures in place. Some say they're not strict enough, but perhaps that's a start.
Right. I mean, one of the things that's being looked at is a greater cameras, putting more cameras in the prisons to keep an eye on what's going on there, and just overall trying to increase the level of supervision in the facilities.
Yeah, the surveillance cameras, supervision, maybe some regulatory efforts. First step for anyone interested in the issue, go to WMYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer's page, and you can see a link to the City Limits report and read that report. And Kelly Varela, thank you very much for being with us today, Deputy Editor at City Limits, and for your report.
Thank you, Jamie.
And coming up next, paper or plastic, car or bike, what is your footprint? We'll talk about bananas next.